All this week, our guests and you have shared your recollections of the September 11th terrorist attacks with us.
I was a kid in college. I was home for the summer, and I remember my father woke me up frantic, and we sat in front of the TV set and watched the second plane go into the second tower.
Activist Valerie Kaur remembers the horror of watching the televised attacks that day, and she recalls her painful realization that this action likely would have personal consequences.
My uncle, my father's brother, works a few blocks away from the World Trade Center, and so we were, you know, panicked and trying to call him, make sure that he was okay. He got out. But within minutes, really, I remember, you know, the towers kept falling on this endless loop, and then soon there was this image of Osama bin Laden, and I realized that our nation's new enemy looked like my family.
Valerie's family of origin, her community, is Sikh American. Sikhism was founded in the 15th century on the Indian subcontinent, and the faith does not share a common history or geography with Islam. But these realities were irrelevant to those acting out of a rage-fueled Islamophobia in the months following 9/11.
Within hours, there was news of hate violence erupting on city streets across the country against Muslim Americans and also against my community, Sikh Americans. Many of our men wear turbans as part of our faith, and so we were at the forefront of that violence.
The alarming violence soon became even more personal for Valerie.
4 days later, on September 15th, I got the phone call from Arizona that Bulbir Uncle had been killed. He was a family friend, a Sikh father who was standing in front of his gas station planting flowers when a man shot him 5 times in the back and called himself a patriot when arrested.
Bulbir Singh Sodhi was the first person to be murdered in a hate crime following September 11th. Valerie has spent the years since his murder advocating for the Sikh American community and others targeted and impacted by hate.
You know, for many Sikh and Muslim Americans, we were afraid of the next terrorist attack. And then we were afraid of walking out of our home for fear that we would be killed or beaten or harmed by our own neighbors. And when I think about that kind of fear, it is an ancient fear. My grandfather sailed by steamship from India to America in 1913. So my family has lived and farmed in California for 100 years. And my grandfather and his generation of immigrants, they fought for equal rights alongside Black leaders who made sure that we had equal protection under the law. And so we had this notion of linear progress, you know, that our grandparents sacrificed so that we would be more free. And there were waves of hate before 9/11, you know, after the Iran hostage crisis. My grandfather used to be called Santa Claus when riding around on his horse and buggy in our small farming town. But after the Iran hostage crisis, he was called the Ayatollah. After the first Persian Gulf War, there was a wave of hate against us. After the Oklahoma City bombing, where the perpetrator was white, there was a wave of hate. And yet, every time we thought of these outbursts of hate as aberrations, you know, in an otherwise like forward-moving story. And so even after 9/11, Melissa, we called that the hate that exploded across the country against people of color the backlash. We saw it when I was traveling around the country filming these stories. We went from city to city, from home to home, sometimes when the blood was still fresh on the ground. And I still thought the documentary that we were making that ended up becoming our first film, Divided We Fall, I thought it was going to be this archive of history, this dark, regrettable chapter of U.S. history. 20 years later, that terror has not ended. We are 5 times more likely to be targets of hate than we were before 9/11. Hate violence never dipped down to the level it was at before 9/11. And now I'm not a college kid anymore. I'm a mother. And as I tie my son's long hair in a bun, in a judah, and I send him to school, I have to reckon with the fact that he's growing up in a nation more dangerous for him than it was for me. So we've let go of that notion of linear progress. And instead, you know, I've looked to Black and Indigenous leaders for my hope, because if we take colonization and slavery as the true starting point for the history of the Americas, then what we have undergone the last 20 years is not an aberration. it is a continuation of what people of color have long had to fight, white supremacy on the soil. And what gives me hope is to see how Sikhs are now standing next to Black people, Indigenous people, Asian people, Latinx people in one voice saying, actually, we can lift our gaze to an America where we all might be free, where we all belong. And that's what's new. That's what's different 20 years later.
Let's talk about that solidarity, because it seems to me that there must surely be at least some moment, particularly maybe in your like 20-year-old self or in the communities, again, when you're driving around the country, when you're making that first documentary film, there must be some impulse by at least some folks to just say, hey, we are not Muslim. We are Sikh. Let me explain how Sikh is different. You know, here are the parts of the world from whence we tend to hail. Here are the parts of the world where Muslims tend to hail. Please leave us alone. We're not them. How do you resist that urge, and maybe not just you personally, but the community, to stoke Islamophobia in order to save one's own self?
Well, there was that impulse in the very, very beginning. There were bumper stickers that some members of our community printed that said, we are Sikhs, not Muslims. But very quickly, our community realized that it actually didn't matter to the person who was aiming the gun at us whether we were Sikh or Muslim. We fit the image of the perpetual foreigner, of the automatically suspect, potentially terrorist. It didn't matter to them what we called ourselves. The violence would explode anyway. And what I saw in interview after interview was how Sikhs resisted that initial impulse because they went back to their ancestors and said, well, our ancestors were known as warriors, as Santh Sapai, sage warriors. The warrior fights, the sage loves. It's a path of revolutionary love. We have stood up for other religious minorities in India for centuries, and so why should we throw another community under the bus on this soil? So that initial impulse was overridden by reaching back to the love ethic at the heart of our faith.
Love can sound like a kind of weak or anemic word and a weak and anemic response to the kind of violence that you're talking about. Why go to a love ethic?
I'm with you. I'm a lawyer. Every time I heard someone stand up on a stage and say love was the answer, I would roll my eyes. Love in the face of institutions that perpetuate injustice, what do you mean? And honestly, Melissa, it was my own existential crisis after my son was born, realizing that you know, with every film, with every lawsuit, with every campaign, I thought we were making the nation safer for the next generation. And then to reckon with the fact that, you know, we need more than sound government. We need more than just policy. What we need in America is a shift in culture and consciousness, a new way of being and seeing that leaves no one behind, a kind of revolution of the heart, that our malady is not just a political one or an economic one, it's a spiritual one, it's a cultural one. And what I saw, you know, every time I've seen people of color on the brink of despair, I've seen the love ethic show up as this muscular, robust force. Love is more than a rush of feeling. Love is sweet labor. It is fierce, bloody, imperfect, life-giving. And when communities in the face of oppression are able to show up with that kind of love to sustain longevity and courage in the face of ongoing oppression, it's life-giving. I remember the last interview I did was when I first really learned this. I had traveled across the world to see the widow of Balbir Singh Sodhi. And at this point, people were telling us to go back to our country. I was starting to feel a kind of bitter despair spread through my chest. And when I found her in the village, she was dressed in white, the color of mourning. And I only, you know, I had this long list of questions. I could only set my questions aside and weep with her. And then I asked her, what would you tell the people of America? And I was expecting that despair, that reproach. And she said, tell them thank you. When I went to America for my husband's funeral, they came out in the thousands, Christian, Jew, Muslim. They did not know me, but they cared with me. They wept with me. They chose to love me. Thank them for their love. Melissa, that moment saved me, and it still saves me because, you know, Balbir Singh Sodhi's name, it's not known to the nation now, 20 years later. His story is not known, even though it should be, and yet, in that small community, they told the story well enough for people to show up and weep. And it didn't stop the violence, but it did heal this widow's heart so that she could go on. And since then, the Sodhi family and Rana, Balbir Uncle's younger brother, has insisted on this love, even reaching out to his brother's murderer a few years ago to forgive him and begin this process of reconciliation. He refused to create another us and them. He refused to let anyone outside of his circle of care. And I keep thinking, if we could do that as a nation, wouldn't that be revolutionary?
Indeed, we're now in a space where we may need to do that as a nation. Not that we haven't, I guess, always been there. But I'm wondering about your thoughts as the final members of the U.S. military evacuated from Afghanistan. Both your thoughts about what you think may happen next, but also what might be possible, perhaps not in a linear way, but in that revolutionary love way, as you've written about.
As I've been watching Afghanistan, I've been holding this question in my heart. You know, the future is dark. Is this the darkness of the tomb or the darkness of the womb? It is both. We have lost so much in the last 20 years. The gas station where Balbir Sodhi was killed is the second ground zero. It's the ground zero for all of the people who have been killed and harmed by the way our nation responded to 9/11. And hate violence at home, and state violence at home, and in the wars on terror abroad. And we can see how that decision to divide the world into us versus them, to respond to aggression with enormous aggression, we can see, looking at Kabul, how that has failed. So yes, it is the darkness of the tomb. And then to sit with that grief and with that rage and with that trauma, and to lift your gaze and to see what is emerging now that perhaps was not emerging before. What if this was the darkness of the womb? What if this was the first moment where America woke up to welcoming refugees? What if this was the moment where we learned from the lessons of two decades and chose to value human dignity above all, to not let fear hijack us anymore? What if our America is not dead, but a nation still waiting to be born? In birthing labor, progress is cyclical, not linear. It's a series of expansions and contractions. And so I don't know how many more turns to the cycle it's going to take before we birth an America where we are all safe and free. But I know that I want to show up to do my part in the labor. And the way that I have found longevity, strength, solidarity, dignity, and that is if I show up with love, a kind of revolutionary love.
Say his name. Balbir Singh Sodhi. Is there a marker where he was killed?
At the corner of the gas station at 80th and University in Mesa, Arizona, there is a plaque where he was killed. And every year, the family turns this gas station into a sacred space. We sing our prayers as the sun sets, and we say his name, and we remember all who have been lost to hate. We'll be gathering again there on September 15th. And this time, we're taking people with us. We'll be live streaming it and bringing a book of prayers, and people can join us at 911hub.org. And at that second ground zero, we'll have the courage to reckon with our past and taking Balbir Uncle's memory in our hearts to lift our gaze and reimagine the future.
Valerie Kaur is a civil rights activist, author of See No Stranger, which was recently released in paperback, and the leader of the Revolutionary Love Project. Valerie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Melissa.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.